following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
It really just gives you that feeling that you're in the outback, but also just one man's almost journey into the brink of madness.
The terrible Australian Bee Jermaine.
There's so many, like, characters in this whole film that are just so interesting, and you can easily just build a whole movie around them.
It contains coarse language.
Yeah, and it sort of wrecks his psychological state to the point where he basically...
Mature themes.
It's important to see this because this is what shit's like. It's not making this shit up. People do go out and do this kind of stuff.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
G'day everyone, this is Bee Jermaine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 5 of the Ozploit Cast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I do a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning right up until today. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy, how are you?
Hello, hello. We are back again. Slightly delayed, but we are back to talk more Ozploitation cinema from, well, at the moment, we're in the mid-70s.
Indeed, and in particular because we're sticking to 1 year this time, because we're going to be talking about 5 films from 1975.
Yes.
And no pun intended there, but how have you been going, Marcy, since we last recorded?
Well, one of these films, and we'll discuss that later, left me scarred for life, but yeah, it's made me so unwell for the last few weeks. we're just cruising through. I think we might be the most locked down place in the world by this point.
Yeah.
The most time spent in hard lockdown. So, you know, we're all going a bit loopy here in Melbourne. And to top it off, as of this episode going live a week ago, we had an earthquake.
Yes.
To top it all off.
Exactly. It's been a weird kind of week and a half here in Melbourne, at least at the time of this recording.
Yeah.
So let's just hope that October, which is the Halloween season, doesn't bring any more craziness to
it. I really hope not. That earthquake was bloody scary, but thankfully nothing was damaged here.
Indeed. Although I think a certain group of people could have easily fallen into a sinkhole, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
Right?
That might be the new exploitation movie that we just decide to make.
Exactly. That's our next project. But Marcy, we are not alone on this episode.
No, I'm very excited because we have a special guest.
Indeed. We have a very special guest who's making her debut appearance on any of our podcasts. However, though, we have been on her show quite a number of times, either together or separately.
Yes.
So we are welcoming the host from the awesome podcast, Schlock and Awe, Lindsay Wilkins. Hello, Lindsay. How are you?
Hey, no, I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on. This is so exciting. No, I've been wanting to come on one of your podcasts for ages. So the fact that I get to come on this very special episode is of 5 movies in 75 is really, really exciting.
Indeed. And we probably scarred you for life with some of the movies that are on this episode.
There's definitely one movie I think actually caused the earthquake. The fact that all three of us sort of watched this one particular movie close at the same proximity. I think that's the reason why Melbourne had the earthquake. It's the only reason I can think of.
Yeah, me too. I pretty much blame that movie for everything that's going on.
Exactly.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you join us, as we've had a lot of fun being guests on Schlock and Awe. And for our listeners, give us a bit of info on what your podcast is and where people can find it.
I have a podcast called Schlock and Awe that is a double feature podcast, essentially. So I like to pair movies that either don't always make sense when you first look at them or are from different sort of generations, genres, That kind of thing. Like your good selves were both on just recently, the last episode that has dropped when we're recording of Mortal Kombat 1995 and also Into the Dragon. So yeah, and we're on all the apps you can find. If you want to follow me on Twitter, schlockenall1, and also on Instagram. No, I'm having a really great time. I just get to talk about people about talking about this wide array of movies, and it's been really, really fun. And yeah, no, it's yeah, that's great.
Yes. But before we actually also get to our topic tonight, I have a question for you, Lindsay. Mm. We always ask this question to all of our guests when they come on the show. What is your relationship with the exploitation movement? Like, what is the, like, one of the earliest exploitation films you can think of that you remember seeing first, and what do you think of the overall subgenre?
I love the overall subgenre. I think it wasn't until I moved to Australia, because I am a Kiwi, so this is going to be interesting getting the Kiwi on to talk about, especially the great McKinsey. But it's got, yeah, so probably more when I moved to Australia, because when in New Zealand it was always your sort of typical Crocodile Dundee, Picnic at Hanging Rock, kind of your more non-exploitative, but you probably could call Crocodile Dundee kind of an exploit, where it kind of fits, even though it doesn't, kind of thing. But I wasn't until I moved to Australia, and then I discovered a little documentary called I'm blanking on it now.
Not quite Hollywood.
Yes, Not Quite Hollywood. And seeing all these bizarre images of people hanging off high wires, mass stupid stunts, people being tied to cars, and you know, then I had to go, okay, I need to watch things like Fair Game. I think one of the first, but I do remember when I first moved to Australia, coming upon one of the Alvin Purple movies. I don't even know why it was playing or what, but watching it going, what the hell? What is this? I don't know. And the, which we'll be getting into. The Australian sex comedy is a very specific thing. So I think, that was like a scarred me for life kind of moment, just because I wasn't expecting it. And then, but then I started to seek out more movies and then sort of discover this kind of rich kind of tapestry of what the hell, let's try and make a movie kind of thing, which is kind of what I love about exploitation. It's just this kind of, we have a camera, we have a little bit of money, we have someone crazy enough to do something very dangerous or get very nude. Let's just do it, which is the she'll be right attitude, which is Australian.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for both of us as well, like, I think that documentary was what opened our eyes more to the subgenre, whereas we probably had seen things like Mad Max and whatnot, you know, more. But having all these things, it's like a whole new world. And doing this podcast, it's a good excuse to just watch Australian cinema and the most obscure Australian cinema.
Oh, yes.
At that. But when you mentioned Crocodile Dundee, I was thinking that's like the big budget exploitation comedy, like, really it is, because it just exploits what people think Australians are and what Australia is. So I think you're on the money with that one for sure.
I was gonna say you could even say that Crocodile Dundee is an even more refined version of the Barry McKenzie films in a way.
Absolutely, yes it is. It's kind of taking that humor of the Barry sort of the McKenzies and even some of the comedies we're going to be talking about, and then kind of just going, okay, so what do you think international audiences are going to do? Because I've even had people in the States sort of ask me, so was Crocodile Dundee a thing in Australia? Went, oh no, Hogan was, like, we knew what Hogan was, but he was a sketch comedian, which seems like almost like a habit in Australia. They start as a sketch comedian they go into other things. Crocodile Dundee was not a character that.
No, was it?
No,
he was just created for the big screen.
Yeah, big screen. Mm. He was never like a thing that we grew up with. It was just all of a sudden, hey, here's this movie, and then everyone knew about it, and then he kind of became what Australians kind of were, even though that is nothing. I mean, I've lived in Australia for quite a few years, but I'm almost offended when I got Crocodile Dundee going, What the hell is this? This is nothing like Australia. What are you talking about?
it's that Australian view from the non-Australian eye.
Yeah.
And, which is kind of funny because you brought up Barry McKenzie, and obviously that started as a comic strip, whereas Crocodile Dundee was just its own thing. So even Barry McKenzie had like a back catalogue of something that was like, let's just make this the most Australia thing you can think of. Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because everyone goes, hangs out with crocodiles. It's like, no, they're actually very dangerous creatures. And we do.
Yeah.
And we go around saying, thank you, that's not a knife, that's a knife.
The knife. Well, I've seen you play Knifey Spoony before.
Exactly. Actually, I will say this. I think I was more offended as a kid by that episode of The Simpsons than I was on
Crocodile. I was so offended by that as a kid, and as an adult, it's the best.
Exactly. Watching it as a New Zealand, growing up as a New Zealand kid, I thought it was the funniest thing in the world. It's like, oh, Auntie!
Mr. Prime Minister!
Oh, we call those Chazwazzers. But we can easily talk about that episode of The Simpsons all day, but we have a show to get to. So this episode I was almost going to say The King's Over, this is the wrong show. that's another show Lindsay will be appearing on in a future episode at some point. But for this episode of the Ozboy cast, like I said, we're going to be talking about five films from 1975. So for this one, we're going to be talking about the films The Great McCarthy, The True Story of Eskimo Nell, The Man from Hong Kong, Plug, and Australia After Dark. So we have five very different films to talk about. Mm. The various degrees of quality, to say the least. we'll get straight to it and talk about our very first film, which, of course, is The Great McCarthy.
McCarthy. Like a lolly? That's how we play the game. Together. And I want to see that togetherness out there today.
That's the idea.
Right up to how I'd put it. Right up where I'd put it, Herbie, any old day.
I've been watching you, you know. And if I thought... Is this room with our dear?
Yes, sir.
No work. Hasn't been too bad. In fact, you're all right, McCarthy. Not you.
Look to the bugger! I know what you're thinking. You're thinking my daughter's an easy lay. Well, let me tell you, she's not.
Looking for someone, Mr. McCarthy?
Who's in your stage, what? You little butler, McCarthy! Beauty! Bloody lovely!
I'm getting my own man. Huh? I'm taking you to the slaughter on Saturday.
All right.
You know what I think? I reckon you think it's as good as a holiday seeing how the other half lives. Cheap restaurants, legal advice to bums and has-beens, sleeping around with...
footballers?
Enjoying your meat bloody pie.
Which was directed by David Baker, written by John Romelli, and it's based on the book A Salute to the Great McCarthy by Barry Oakley. And this film stars John Jarrett, who made his acting debut in this film, Judy Morris, Barry Humphreys, Chris Haywood, Max Gillies, and Bruce Spence. And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading off IMDb, is... McCarthy is a country football player who was kidnapped by the South Melbourne Football Club and made a star player in the city. Now, I know this movie was a first time watch for all of us, and I'd never even heard of this film before I actually started putting this list together.
No, same.
And the great things about when I put this list for the Our podcast together is just finding films I've never even heard of before.
Yeah.
Discovering them for the show. But Marcy, tell us your thoughts on The Great McCarthy.
Yeah, so I like you said, hadn't even heard of this film, and as I was preparing to watch it, that's when I kind of found out that was like John Jarrett's like first lead role in a film. So that I had no idea about. I didn't even realize it was about football at first, and I'm not much of a footy person. You know, the grand finals just happened. I didn't watch it. I got no idea. I haven't really been into football or AFL, Australian rules football, for many years, and my team have been doing shit, so kind of lost interest for a while. Maybe when they get better, I'll start again. But yeah, at least knowing a bit about footy kind of helps a little, but I don't think it was necessary. And it's based on a novel, and you can sort of see that a bit. And I think, like, first, what I think doesn't quite work is tonally it's just kind of all over the place. I don't think it really settles on what kind of film it wants to be. Like, there's serious moments, there's really funny moments, and they don't, they just come out of nowhere. There's no real structure to it, and that can take you out of it a bit. I think the the flatulence in this film, for whatever reason, was just so off-putting, because I'm like, this movie shouldn't have that kind of overly ochre type of humor, but I can kind of see what they were going for. But at the same time, I actually found it quite engaging in a weird way. I was, you know, invested in this character and just seeing the sort of ins and outs of this whole football, trying to get, you know, the best player on the team and such and such, and kind of the weird relationships between the main character. And going back to one of the films we've already watched previously, Peterson, which was one of the very early roles or main roles for Jack Thompson, this is kind of like almost the prequel in a way, because the character is almost like the younger version of that character when he's first getting into sport, whereas Peterson is kind of that look of that the after you've played the game, you're retired and doing other work. So they kind of make interesting companion pieces. But I think Peterson, because it knew what kind of film it was structured and it flowed a lot better, whereas I think this one struggled a little. But I still found it strangely engaging, and it was very fascinating to see, like, John Jarrett in that early lead role. I'm rambling, so...
But I was gonna say, because I'm looking up, like, you know, sort of info on this film, like, as you was sort of saying your thoughts, and apparently there is a connection to John Jack Thompson in this film, because the director of this film, David Baker, actually directed the segment The Family Man from Libido, which we talked about a few episodes back. So I only discovered that just now. But Lindsay, tell us your thoughts on The Great McCarthy.
No, I kind of agree with Marcy in a few ways, because I think especially the tonal, weird tonal shifts, it's kind of, which seems to be a theme of these group of 1975 movies, is that everything seems very episodic. And there does seem to be the skit movie sort of happening in behind what John Jarrett's doing. It's just John Jarrett isn't that funny. I mean, not to say there's a pejorative, he's playing a drama when I think the whole movie's not. Because you do have weird farts, and you do have a weird office worker who's trying to be his girlfriend and then keeps doing that whole thing of, like, hey, I hate you. Why are you treating me like this? Let's get married. Kind of thing. And it's – so, yeah, I don't think it quite knows what tone it's doing, but it sort of fits in well with the other movies. But John Jarrett is – so it looks like he's 12, but he's actually really engaging. Like, I think you're following him more than you are the movie, because it's fascinating to see him go through this – very muddy paddock when he's playing the sport, and it's kind of for the love of the game. And then he goes to, and I always love watching movies set in Melbourne before, like decades before, like seeing 1970s Melbourne is especially South Melbourne, is fascinating. Like, I swear there's a shot where they're running up Swanston Street and it's just like, oh my God, it's changed, but it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
yeah, so I think that's it, but I think it's so kind of vignette-y because you can tell it's adapted from a book because it's so kind of like, oh, we're going to do this bit, this bit. Mm. It feels very vignette-y in a way that I don't think completely comes together. But I think it's very, it's actually a very endearing movie, mainly because of that John Jarrett performance.
Yeah.
That I think he's taking everything so seriously that you actually do believe that he is this guy who wants to be part of the South Melbourne Swans, is it? Or the.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, before they moved to Sydney.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they got the red and white.
I don't know the early, like, 70s days of football, but yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I'm so, sure we'll get corrected by City fans.
Yeah. Like, coming in from not knowing anything about the sport at all. And it's kind of fascinating in that respect. But yeah, it's a strange little movie, but not the strangest of the bunch. I think it's probably more the least strangest, but it's kind of a sweet little movie that's trying a whole bunch of different things because they think that's what you're meant to do in a movie, it feels like.
Yeah, I definitely, I kind of feel the same way in that regard, but it's like, you know, the pattern I've seen with a lot of these films, and I think probably episode two, some of those films, like I think we talked about Stalk, how, and even sort of like Barry McKenzie and Alvin Purple, with that comedy type, which they were trying to do here, they all feel very, like you said, vignette-y. And it's just like scene to scene to scene. Whereas I think this would have benefited more from not doing that and maybe taking that more serious but not overly serious approach, whereas putting in that ochre comedy kind of derailed it a bit. Like in some scenes it lightens the mood, but others it doesn't. But I think what kept me engaged, and much like yourself, Lindsay, is... it was John Jarrett's like performance in that character that I found myself very invested in, you know, seeing his journey. And that's what really, kept me going with this. And it's an interesting film and, an interesting look because, you know, for as big as sports is in this country, there aren't that many sports movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to see something early, like it's quite interesting to see even that very small, what's the right word? Like not growth, but change of how the sport movie has progressed. But yeah, for a country obsessed with sport, there are not really that many sports movies.
That's a really good point, because if you're sort of watching Australian movies, you'd say, yes, they're obsessed with cars, which Australians are, but there isn't that sporting element where you go, oh, I get that Australians are obsessed with sport. And you're like, but if you come here, then you realise, oh, no, we're obsessed with absolutely sport, and especially sports we're good at.
Yeah, and it's weird that there aren't more films about this whole thing. And you look that we've been in this pandemic for like, you know, 20 months or something. What's the one thing that they've managed to keep going despite everything? Oh. It's sport.
Okay, which state doesn't have COVID? Right, we're going there.
Pretty much. Yeah. Bede, your turn for some thoughts.
Yeah, well, it was interesting watching this film. I don't think I was taken to this film as much as you both were. And I think mainly because I'm not an AFL person at all. Like, the game just doesn't interest me at all. I grew up in New South Wales and sort of was more around rugby league than anything else, but even then I wasn't that was kind of like more forced upon me since my whole family was into it. And I wouldn't say I've ever been a sports person, but I'm aware of like how at least rugby league and that works. So going into this film, I was kind of curious to see how it would go. And I don't know, it doesn't really grab me as much as I thought it would be. And I think one of the main reasons why that is that kind of inconsistent tone that we've already been discussing. Because apparently sort of reading up, like early drafts were kind of more, definitely had a very set tone. But as the script kept being written and more drafts were done, that's when they added more slapstick and more sex comedy and that, so it can be more in the vein of something like the Barry McKenzie films or the Alvin Purple films. And I think having that sort of wacky comedy with these kind of more serious elements within the story, It really kind of makes it incredibly uneven. And I think it really sort of put, for me as a viewer, at a distance to kind of fully embrace it, especially because with John Jarrett, like, he is so young in this film. I think he's like, I think he might have been 22, 23 at the time when he made this film.
Yeah, it was a baby face.
And you got, here's who's playing it completely straight. And then you have all these other actors around him. Outside of Judy Morris, who plays his kind of love interest in the film, all the other actors, you know, like Barry Humphries, Chris Haywood, Bruce Spence, Matt Gillies and all that, they play these very heightened, over-the-top, wacky characters. And it doesn't really sort of come together as a whole. And I think, kind of adding, trying to make this one another... I guess another Alvin Purple or Barry McKenzie film kind of worked against it for me. But I did find it interesting what you both say, like, now that I think about it now, given how popular sport is here in Australia, we don't really have that many sports films, particularly with AFL. And I can think of a few off the top of my head. Like, I know Jack Thompson did an AFL film called The Club, which Bruce Pittsford and David Williams made, and that was kind of more of the behind the scenes of a club and that, more than the actual game itself. And then Australian Rules, which came out in the early 2000s, but that was kind of more these players and how they sort of dealt with the sort of racism in this town. So there are movies that have AFL out there, but those were kind of more sort of like in the background more than anything. But something like this film actually has it front and center. Yeah.
You're actually on the field. So
yeah.
I think they, like those scenes, like I think they were mixed between actual scenes and then John Jarrett and that on the field. And I think they actually did that really well. Like those, you couldn't really tell the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Most of the like you're not really looking for it, but. You know, I think it kind of flowed pretty well for me, at least with those.
Yeah, like those scenes in particular were very well edited. And you would think, oh, John Jarrett's actually out there playing the actual game. And like they sort of edited in a way so that, yeah, it looked like he was there amongst the team. And I know he did actually train with the South Melbourne football team in prep for this film. So it does.
Because
really
I think he did actually play it in school or something. Did I read that? I may have misread. But I think he was actually familiar in how to play footy rules, Australian rules. But no, it's kind of surprising. I'm surprised there wasn't a footy rules movie in the kind of the late 90s, early 2000s Australian comedy kind of, I guess, boom. Like Crackerjack or Bad Boys or something, Bad Egg. I'm surprised that there wasn't this kind of cozy, all the weirdos playing Australian Aussie rules kind of movie. That, or even League or something, that really surprised me. Because it would have been the kind of thing that would have, I thought would have happened. And then, but yeah, maybe just because they think, oh, we're the, no one else understands Aussie rules, so why would we make a movie about it?
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's probably the thing, because Australian rules is such a very specific sport here in Australia. And I think international audiences, if they saw the film, would be very confused about what is going on. Even me being an Aussie and not familiar with the sport at all, I was confused on, like, what are the actual rules and how is this game supposed to play? I mean, I know the basics, like you got to kick the ball into the goals and stuff like that. But outside of that, I don't know anything of, like, any of the rules. And I guess all those kind of elements, like, didn't really sort of, for me as a viewer, really grab me as much as it could have been. But that's just me, though.
You know, you look at it like with, like, American sports movies. Like, we don't – I mean, people play, like, gridiron here, but it's not – no one really gives a shit here. People watch the Super Bowl to get tanked.
Yes.
Monday. But watch a film with their football, and a lot of the time you don't need to understand anything, because if it's telling a good story, you're engaged. So I think there's sort of two. I mean, Americans think everyone has everything they do when we don't.
It's like,
But yeah, I think if we can manage to watch sports movies about sports we have no fucking idea on, like, this country could make sports movies for a worldwide audience and be introduced, like, hey, here's AFL, or this is why we love cricket, or here's rugby, blah, 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 blah. Mm. But I was going to go back to Peterson. Was he a footballer or rugby player? I think it was rugby in that
part. I think he was rugby or rugby union.
Yeah, it was one of
those. It was one of the two, yeah.
Yeah, and I think because you know how that had that more serious tone, but it had sort of the more playful moments. I think that's what this one sort of needed to be. But as you've mentioned, like, the director of this directed that short in
Libido.
You can kind of see that he's got that weird, a very weird sort of humor. But I'm not necessarily sure. I mean, whether it's the director or, you know, whoever sort of put this bit, I just don't think it suited this. But, you know.
Yeah, John Jarrett feels like he's in a different movie than what is actually happening in the movie, especially the office scenes. That feels like it's something out of Monty Python. Like that very strange hierarchy of the stuffy man in the suit or his kind of thing. It's very, and these very different kind of, everyone has to be quirky in this movie, except for Jarrett, who's not. And maybe the movie would have been better if they'd kind of picked the tone, especially maybe more that is a serious, more endearing tone that sort of goes to the rise and fall and love of the game and all that kind of thing. But yeah, you're sort of going, okay, so what, usually I'm fine with it, but there's sometimes I'm like, okay, what movie am I in now?
It definitely does that a lot with this one. You're sort of like, what? Okay.
Especially when you have, like, Barry Humphries, again, up in makeup and costumes and stuff like that. And from what I've read, he pretty much ad-libbed most of his lines in this film. And, but to be, even though I am a bit down on this film, one thing I will say, at least I felt was the most engaging part, was actually the stuff where it showed, like, McCarthy as he as dealing with his fame, you know, like him being used in like sponsorships, and particularly that TV commercial where he
they kind of forcing
the dress up in a in a superhero costume, and he's like, and yeah, you know, stuff like that actually, kind of reminded me a bit of Rocky II in that way, how does he deal with becoming famous and all that. The movie doesn't go into it as much as it could have been, at least in that regard. But I always found that, at least that subplot of this film, more interesting than, say, the other stuff around it.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, because John Jarrett is the main through line in all of that. And you can sort of see him, like, why are they putting me in this ridiculous thing? Why do I have to advertise tea of all things or something? He's got, like, a tea when he's being flying fox down a building.
And I was amazing. He was able to see while he was hanging, like, down there on the rope, upside down. So that was amazing.
So you can kind of get that stuff. It's just sort of all the stuff sort of happening around him that I was kind of going, but, well, yeah, does that really need to be? Okay, that's – but then again, I had seen this movie after watching – Plug and the True Story of Eskimo Nell. So I was not going, oh, well, this is just obviously what was happening in Australia in 1975.
It definitely goes in the tone of how they were approaching that sort of ochre type of comedy. And it's just, it's a film that I don't think necessarily needed that.
But there's the movies that were maybe making money, like, as you said, Barry McKenzie and Alan Purple. So they're like, well, we have to do this because this is what obviously people are wanting to go watch. And it's like, well, yeah, but just don't throw it in when it doesn't necessarily need to be there. There can be, you can make other movies.
Well, it didn't really work out for the movie in the end because the film was both a critical and box office flop as well. So, and as we've stated, like, we've never even heard of this film until, you know, doing this show. And that's probably the reason why that is, because, you know, most people don't either know about it or really sort of really care that much about it. So, we'll wrap up on this conversation for this film. But Marcy, tell us your final thoughts and rating for The Great McCarthy.
I think I've summed up like how I felt. I think it was an okay film. I was pretty engaged for the most part. Just, yeah, like we said, it's sort of tonally a bit all over the place. It's vignette-y. It's a bit too ochre for maybe what it should have been. But overall, I gave it 3 out of 5. I still did get, you know, a bit of enjoyment out of it. And, you know, seeing John Jarrett in that, like, very early role and how he kind of tackled this in this very bizarre movie was interesting. So, yeah.
And how about yourself, Lindsay? What is your final thoughts and rating for The Great McCarthy?
yeah, even though this movie is a mess because it doesn't exactly know what it wants to be, I still thought it was really endearing, mainly because of John Jarrett's performance, and because he, even though he's baby John Jarrett, and I just love the fact that it is Melbourne in the 1970s. So I gave it three stars out of five, sorry. And yeah, because I think there's some really interesting stuff in there, but it's mainly looking at Melbourne in the 1970s and John Jarrett's performance and this kind, and some of how the footy games are cut together, even if it is, it's a mess.
I guess I'm a bit more down on this film than both of you. So I gave this film about 2 out of 5. I think John Jarrett is pretty solid in the film, but I think the inconsistent tone and also my unfamiliarity, I'll probably butcher that word, so please forgive me, with AFL, it just sort of kind of put me more off at a distance as a viewer, so I wasn't really fully engaged by it overall. But I think for fans of AFL, I think it should definitely be a watch. Like, if you like the sport and want to see movies about it, I'd say, yep, if you're interested, definitely give this film a watch. If it's and I mean, I don't think it's as quite on the level as, you know, like I said, the Barry McKenzie films or the Alvin Purple films and how, or even Stork in terms of how they sort of approached the Orca comedy. But yeah, I feel like this, if it was played more sort of something comedy drama rather than more slapsticky, I think it probably would have worked better overall. But we'll move right along to our next film, which is another Orca comedy, although this one is a Western as well. And that, of course, is the true story of Eskimo Nell.
For centuries, this book has provided the inspiration for countless millions. Its verses have been read and recited and written again and again by generation after generation. But only the Australian motion picture industry would have dared to bring you the true story of Eskimo Nell.
Are you kidding? There's a day coming when I'm going to stick me dick in the heart of the earth. And the bang will be heard in Alaska.
Only the Australian motion picture industry could have brought you the two most immortal characters of the greatest bawdy saga ever written.
Dick's the name. Dead-Eye Dick.
Mexico Pete. Yeah, listen, Dead-Eye, keep out of my hair. I don't need you. I don't want you.
You ain't go cross-eyed when you blow.
Dirty minded, sneaky little puff, mate. Next time I'll aim at your face and you'll lose your other eye.
On a rip-roaring adventure from the frozen north to the land of Oz with Deadeye Dick and Mexico Pete in their search for Eskimo Nell. Only the Australian motion picture industry would have dared to bring you the true story of Eskimo Nell.
You ever stuck your dick in a bucket of cream and stirred till it was butter?
Which was directed by Richard Franklin, which he made his directorial debut here. And he, for those out there who don't know who he is, would go on to direct films such as Patrick, Road Games, Psycho 2, and many others. And we'll be talking about some of those films in the future. The film was written by Richard Franklin and also Alan Hopgood, who actually wrote the two Alvin Purple films. It's also based on the poem, The Ballad of Eskimo Nell. And this film stars Max Gillies, Serge Lazareff, Butcher Vajon, Jerry Thomas, and Abigail. And the plot summary for this film, which once again I'm reading off IMDb, is the film's unlikeliest protagonist in a mild mannered window peeper named Deadeye Dick Max, who spies on a Mexican couple. That is not the plot summary for this film. I need to find a better one.
I take issue with mild-mannered Peeping Tom. The next book is not mild-mannered in anyway.
Yes. Yeah, I think I might have applied a better plot
that's summary. That's pretty much like the first 5 minutes of that film.
All right, I might, okay, I found a better one. So, and the plot summary is based and inspired by the bawdy Ballad of Eskimo Nell, which has been banned in Australia. The film tells the story of Deadeye Dick and Mexico Peak setting forth through the Australian outback in search of the infamous prostitute, but by today's standards and, you know, much more politically correct term, sex worker, Eskimo Nell. So, Marcy, what did you think of the true story of Eskimo Nell, which, of course, is Richard Franklin's directorial debut?
Yeah, I want to say maybe I had heard of this before, but there is another film called Eskimo Nell, which is a lot more popular or famous, whatever.
Actually, it was came out the same year as this film, and directed by future GoldenEye and Casino Royale director Martin Campbell. So.
Yeah, so maybe I'd heard of that and not this one, so I don't know. Again, I actually didn't realize this was Richard Franklin's like first like feature film as director, so I was like, oh, this is very bizarre. Okay. But this is, again, this is a weird film, but a weird, very watchable film. Again, I had no idea what to expect from this. And it does have that weird, bizarre sex comedy stuff, like, in the beginning. But then as it progresses with this, like, friendship and journey between these two very bizarre, silly characters, it turns into this, like, film about like this friendship, and then as it progresses it like unravels to some very interesting things, and it kind of does the ochre-ish comedy a little bit less, but when it does it sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. In one case I actually found myself laughing when there's this whole like fart sequence when they're camping out or whichever. I actually found that funny, whereas in the previous film we talked about, I was just like, this is ridiculous. So I don't know why that is. But it ends up being this very endearing film about a friendship that these two men end up forming. And it's a very weird one. I was not expecting what we got, and I think that's almost why I was very fascinated by it. Yeah.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts on the true story of Eskimo Nell?
I think by the end, this one movie won me over. For the first 20 minutes, though, I was a bit, oh, no, what did I get myself into? What is this movie? Why is Max Gillis obsessed with what's his name's cum face? I don't like any of this. This is bad. But you're right. I think that stuff does stop, and it kind of stops being a sex comedy. Again, it's very vignette-y, all that kind of stuff we were talking about with The Great McCarthy. But you do kind of get caught up in this friendship about these two guys who are on this road trip, essentially, through colonial Australia, and they sort of stop off. I'm guessing at Eureka?
Yeah,
Eureka, they do. Right? Yeah, all this kind of thing that kind of evolves sort of around Australian colonial history. And it's... yeah, and you do kind of get won over by it. So the time you get to the end, and the whole thing is kind of, I love how I kind of got caught up in the whole fact of, oh, this is Australian yarn telling at its kind of core. This is when you tell that story that isn't exactly true, but you embellished it. I mean, this is chopper all over. And then you do get caught up in their friendship, and you do kind of get caught up in these kind of guys' storytelling and kind of the storytelling of Australia, which is always like a little bit true, like 1-2% true, but the rest is usually bullshit. And I think, yeah, it won me over. It took a while. I was sort of sitting there going, oh no, because I'm not the biggest Alvin Purple fan, and just because that humor I've just never been able to kind of connect with. And I was kind of worried, and then I went, Richard Franklin directed this? And then by the end I was kind of like, oh, actually this was a lot sweeter than I thought it was going to be. And I'd heard of the other movie by Campbell, not this one, so I was expecting something completely different. Which is why I was thrown off.
Yeah, like, it's very bizarre how it changes within that first sort of that first act, where it's like, oh, this is a bit weird. I don't know what. Wait, what?
Yeah. How many dick jokes do we need? Okay, we're gonna need a lot of those. Okay, and then it kind of stops. It's kind of that. Yeah.
It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
I'm kind of the same as well. Like, when I went into this film, I just automatically assumed everything I've read about the true story of Eskimo Nell is that it's, you know, a sort of a, you know, a raunchy sex comedy, but set in this, you know, but done it as a Western. And that's what I had. And I knew Richard Franklin, this was his first film. So I was kind of curious to see how, because I know him as a filmmaker who directs either horror or thriller films. So it was kind of interesting to see, like, his very first film happens to be a raunchy comedy. So going into it, I kind of knew what to expect. And for a while there, like, this movie basically was what I thought it was going to be. Basically, the film starts off with reading of the passage of the actual Eskimo Nell poem. And then it just goes into Deadeye Pete, played by Max Gillies, who, of course, we talked about in the on The Great McCarthy, spying on Serge Lazarev, who plays Mexico Pete having sex with a woman. And tell me if I don't know if it was just me, but Serge Lazarev looked like sort of like a mixture of David Carradine and Ben Mendelsohn, like the combination of those two actors together as one person.
Yes, yes, he
did. Just freaked me out. and just him, like, spying on this guy and being like Denny from The Room and watching you guys and stuff like that. Yeah. It's just like, what is up with this guy? And even Mexico Pete was even feeling the same way too. And then, and of course, they go on this journey together to look for this sex worker, mythical sex worker, I should say, named Eskimo Nell, particularly who Deadeye Dick is looking for, because he killed her husband or partner, played by wrestler Butcher Bashar, which I know Marcy would have been like kind of blown away by that he was in this film.
Yeah, like, how random was that?
And so they had set off on this journey and they get up into shenanigans and more sexcapades and stuff like that. And but then as the movie kind of progresses and they get to the third act where they finally find Eskimo Nell, and it's okay because this is a spoiler podcast, we can talk about this stuff. The movie switches gears and actually becomes kind of this tragedy in a way, because, and I was really taken aback by that, and it actually made me appreciate the film a lot more, because, like, as we were talking about with The Great McCarthy, how it sort of tries to mix sort of slapstick comedy with drama, but it never really found the tone. I feel like Eskimo Nell did it very successfully, because all the sort of dramatic stuff, when you look back on the film, is there throughout the first two acts, but sort of subtly hit, because we get these kind of little dream sequences that Deadeye Dick has, which is like done in the style of a silent film where he's with Eskimo Nell, and then she sort of like walks away, gets on like a bit of ice, and then goes down the river. And you think, oh, this is going to be a funny thing, but those scenes in particular are treated very seriously. And you're like, okay, what's going on here? But then as the film progresses, we realize that there's a sadness to this character because he's, well, dying. And the one last thing he wants to do before he dies is find Eskimo Nell and make love to her. But he can't perform. So that's why he was found Mexico Pete, because he feels like he can perform for him. So, and also by the end, like the friendship between these two guys is actually very moving, and like they do actually, you know, find love with each other and all that. And I found it kind of such, I did not expect that at all this film, and I was really pleasantly surprised. Like, this was a film that, yeah, I knew it was going to be a raunchy comedy, but I didn't expect it to kind of surprisingly find it very moving by the end of it as well.
No, this is how you mix genres or tones. And you can do that. It's not to say that every movie has to be one tone or kind of one style. And I think when you watch the true story of Eskimo Nell, you can see him, how he's, because I love Richard Franklin as a director. I think he's done some amazing, amazing work and is able to kind of subtly shift tones, especially in, say, Psycho 2, with his relationship with his mother at the end, and how, what that's leading to, and then everything that's happening with I can't remember the character's name. Anyway, you know Psycho 2, you kind of know that ending. And same with this, because it starts off and you get the sense that Deadeye Pete is been following Deadeye Bill has been following Mexico Pete. I think, yeah, sorry, I'm getting mixed up.
Deadeye Dick, yeah.
Yeah, is following him around, watching him have sex, and you don't realize why. You just think they keep going on about, oh yes, this is your orgasm face, and it's like, so you're following around this guy, watching him have sex. What is happening? And it's very kind of baldy. It's very Australian kind of that awkward humor. And then by the time, and before you know it, time you get to the end, it's kind of this, oh, actually, it's about these two guys. Yeah, you're right. He wants him to have sex with this guy right now because he can't and he's dying. But he still wants to fulfill this fantasy. And the whole movie is about these kind of different fantasies. So those sequences kind of work. Whereas in The Great McCarthy, they didn't, because they're all meant to be within one present kind of thing. So, it really surprised me by the end. I had to watch the ending again because it was not the ending I expected to this movie. It still works as a punchline, but at the same time, it's really sweet, and you want him to go upstairs with him, even if she's like not that interested or whatever. But you still want her. But you still want that to happen for Deadeye, and it's surprisingly sweet when it comes. It doesn't come out of nowhere when you think about it, but it feels like it does.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting film, and I mean, if people have seen, the more, I guess, well-known Richard Franklin films, and you find him interesting, this is one to watch, because it's quite fascinating, to be honest.
Mm. And I like how, like you were saying, Lindsay, like when they actually find Eskimo Nell, and they find out that the picture they had of Eskimo Nell is not what she actually really looks like. Like, she's in the picture that Deadeye Dick has, like this beautiful, like slender woman. But when they actually meet her, she's, you know, a lot more believable sex worker, and she's overweight and all that. Like, any other movie would treat that as a joke and as a punchline. The film doesn't, which I found really surprisingly. And actually, like, even despite, you know, finding out the truth, Deadeye Dick is still madly in love with her and wants to make love to her, but of course, like, he gets really drunk and then makes a complete fool of himself, and he just can't perform. And like, it's surprisingly how the movie, like I said, it could have easily have gone for that joke, like, you know, mistaken identity and stuff like that, and it doesn't do that, and it actually decides to take it a much more sort of sadder kind of approach.
Yeah, and I really actually think the sort of fantasy scenes are actually shot really, really well. Like, you're definitely into this fantasy, but you can definitely see, like, who's, like, the vision behind the camera with how it's been directed, how it's been shot and lit. Like, it all just kind of comes together really well with that. And it's so different that you're aware that it is, like, a fantasy element. But I actually felt like the performances too, actually really good. Like, they have a very interesting dynamic and back and forth that it actually just really works.
Max Gillies, who's been quite a lot of the films we've talked about up to this point, but as a supporting character or has small roles. And so this is like his first kind of major lead role. And I thought he did such a great job. And Serge Lazareff, I thought, was great as Pete as well. But it's interesting kind of like knowing the approach that Richard Franklin took, because he, even though, this film's known as a sex comedy, he never intended it to be made that way or make that sort of film when he made this. And I was watching a bit of the doco on the DVD that I had of this film, and he sort of says, like, his kind of inspirations for this film was to make a film that was a mixture of, like, Blazing Saddles, Cat Ballou, and Midnight Cowboy, which and I can definitely see those elements, particularly when it comes to the friendship of these two characters, because they did remind me of, like, John Voight and Dustin Hoffman's characters in Midnight Cowboy in a way.
And there's definitely a lot of Blazing Saddles in there.
Especially once they go to the mines and then all that crazy stuff happens, which I did thought was pretty hilarious. And
it was kind of weird because I was sort of sitting stony faced a little bit going, why am I watching this? And all of a sudden, I think it must have been at the Eureka Mine, I had a surprise giggle. It's like, oh yeah, that's actually kind of funny. And that's when I think this movie opened up for me a little bit, because I thought, oh, okay, crap, it's gonna be another sex comedy. Yep, here we go. But I think it is a little bit smarter than that. I think an easy way to sell this movie is, yes, the the first 15-20 minutes of this is probably what he used to sell the movie. Yes, Barry McKenzie's popular, Alvin Purple's popular, so let's make it like this. But he's got something else going on under the surface about these two friendship, which, yes, when you say I'm blanking the movie that you just said. Midnight Cowboy. God, it was a great movie. And you can kind of see the dependent relationship with both of them. Mm. I think he really captures that because you kind of start understanding why Serge is starting to hang around with Max Gillis, who's essentially just following him around like a puppy. Like, I need you to help me. I need you to help me, because he knows he's going to need help for this kind of thing that he needs to do. And I like the fact that, you know, reason find out why he's been following him around is because he's been kind of sussing him up, saying, is this the guy that's going to be able to help me? And it's quite a sweet friendship at the end. And it is more about their friendship than actually the sex in it. And even when you do get to the end, it's still very sad. It's very poignant. I love the fact that they don't turn Eskimo Nell into just one fat joke, even though they're so close to being that. But they don't do it, and it's sort of more the realistic situation of a sex worker in 1880s Australia. It's much more transactional, matter of fact, and probably just very boring in a lot of respect. So it's it's a really sweet movie, surprisingly, and yeah, it's kind of got, as I said, I did not like, but only because I thought, oh, okay, I think I know what this is. Yep. And then this movie just completely surprised me.
So we'll wrap up our chat on the true story of Eskimo Nell. Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting film that manages to be more than what it sort of looks like on the surface. It dives deep into, you know, creating a solid friendship throughout this film, and it doesn't need to rely on, you know, that sex comedy stuff at all. And it's definitely a very interesting film. I gave it 3 out of 5.
And what about you, Lindsay?
I think this is a really interesting little movie. I think it's nothing, not... There are a few movies within this group that I think really, really surprised me. And this is the one that did the most special by the end, but I'm giving it 3.5 out of 5.
Awesome. I'm the same as well. I give it about 3.5 as well. I think it's an enjoyable little film, but also a very sort of surprisingly poignant and moving film as well. And I do love the performances of Max Gillies and Serge Lazarev. I think they did such a really good job with their performances. And I, like we've sort of said before, it finds that perfect balance between sort of raunchy comedy and also poignant drama as well. So, and also it's a pretty solid film about male friendships as well. So, it's a pretty solid film, and we'll definitely be talking about Richard Franklin more in the future, particularly on the next episode, because he did direct Phantasm, so we'll see how that goes. We'll move right along to before I wrap up, this film actually has two figures behind the scenes who would also go on to be major players in the Ozploitation movement. I was shot by Vincent Morton, who would actually go on to shoot Road Games first, Snapshot, Long Weekend, and many other Australian films as well, and also was the was composed by Brian May. Nope, not Brian May from Queen. This is a different Brian May, Brian May would also score the Mad Max films as well. Mm. So, and we'll be talking about more of his work in the future. But we'll move right along to our next film, which is one I'm very excited to talk about. And that, of course, is the action martial arts film, The Man from Hong Kong.
From the man from Hong Kong.
Listen, there's a Chinese cop in town. He's beginning to annoy me. Yeah, I think he should meet with a slight accident.
Jimmy Wong Yu is the man from Hong Kong. A furious arsenal of martial arts. His sights set on smashing organized crime.
In my country, Caroline, we have a sport. We take the giant praying mantis, put him in the wooden cage, and make him fight for his life with his own kind. I thought you would enjoy such a sport.
You and Jack Wilton in a wooden cage. He's a very dangerous man.
George Lazenby is Jack Wilton. Gunrunner, dope peddler, ruthless czar of international evil. East meets West in a head-on clash with no holds barred. Golden Harvest, who made Bruce Lee a box office smash, have joined with Australia's action specialists to produce a death-defying spectacle that staggers the senses.
Don't give me any shit.
Provoke him at your peril.
I want that lunatic stopped.
Nothing stands in his way. For long, nobody's safe. From the man from Hong Kong.
Which was written and directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, which I believe was his narrative directing debut after making so many documentaries, including the one we talked about on the previous episode, The Love Epidemic. This film stars Jimmy Wang Yu, George Lazenby, Hugh Keyes-Byrne, that damn sexy Roger Ward. Ron Spears, Rebecca Gilling, and Frank Turing. I probably butchered his last name, so please forgive me. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb. While on dispatch in Australia to extradite a drug courier, a tough Hong Kong cop wages a one-man war against Sydney's most powerful kingpin. Now, Marcy, I'd never seen The Man from Hong Kong until we most recently discussing it now for the show. It's what I've been wanting to see, and after I watched it, I had a feeling you might love this movie. And am I right in that regard?
Yes, I had not seen this film properly until watching it for this podcast, and I was aware of this one. They do talk a bit about it in not quite Hollywood, but it's more of a well-known film. I think it was Australia's first martial arts type film, in that sort of from the 60s to 70s, the Eastern cinema of that martial arts type thing was really emerging, and everyone kind of wanted a piece of that. But at the same time, it's the James Bond style of film was also quite big, and being that the villain was played by George Lazenby, who did play Bond for one time. But watching this, I'm like, why the fuck wasn't he just a Bond villain? He would have been perfect. He's actually so good in this. I think he's great. In this film, he's got a lot of personality. But this is just a really fun, action-packed, crazy, at times very laughable with some of the stuff in their film. It's just nuts. It's crazy. There's just so much enjoyment to be had. You've got such a strong cast. I didn't necessarily think that Jimmy Wang Yu was the best, and his dubbing was terrible. Hugh Keyes-Byrne, I thought, was great in that role. And, our sexiest senior citizen, Roger Ward, was also great in this as well. But it's got a very strong, fun cast. It's a very easy story to follow. There are very laughable moments where what's the character's name?
Inspector Fang Sing Leng.
Yeah, I'll just call him the inspector because it's easier. When he goes on the date or whatever with the random chick he manages to find, and it's just the worst love scene you will ever see.
Walking through the countryside.
And then she's like, I'm going to make love to you now. And I'm like, what is this? it's that James Bond sexual type of stuff. But I think this is just the fun thing with these kind of Brian Trenchard-Smith films is it makes it a lot of fun. The stunts are insane.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, you know, I don't know if I can add anything that hasn't been said about this film before. It's just so much fun, and it's good to see something that feels a bit more big budgety, even though it's not, and just really go balls to the walls with it and kind of incorporate like this different blend of like you know, Hong Kong cinema into Australian films, and I think it really worked, and it brings something very different from what we've seen so far with exploitation films. But as I understand, I believe Jimmy Wang Yu was not the easiest man to work with, and I think that kind of shows. But it's actually really, I don't think I quite realized that Sammo Hung not only had a small role, but I believe he was one of the choreographers.
He was the fight choreographer on this film.
I never realized that till to watching it. I'm like, oh, damn, like, you couldn't have got anyone better. Mm. The man is a bona fide legend.
I could say, because
everyone knows this movie by now.
Indeed. And Lindsay, tell us your thoughts on The Man from Hong Kong.
I love this movie. This is I wanted to do this episode because of The Man from Hong Kong. And not realizing I was going to, what other movies I'd be getting into.
That's the thing that gets everyone. It's like, I want to come and talk about this film. I have to watch these other four as well.
Yep. That's how we get you.
That's how you get people. This was one of the movies I wanted to track down after Not Quite Hollywood because it looked insane. This movie is kind of one of those delightfully bonkers. Yes, it's got mixing sort of the Shaw Brothers martial arts. It's mixing the James Bond kind of thing and the fact that they do actually get George Lazenby. The fact that it has Hugh Keyes-Byrne, Roger Ward. I think, did I see Bill Hunter pop up at like for 2 seconds?
I believe he did pop up in this movie.
I think so.
I mean, because I always sort of said it has to be legally, it's only an Australian movie when Bill Hunter turns up. So this is legally an Australian movie. No, it's just delightfully bonkers and silly and doesn't take itself too serious except for Jimmy Wang Yu. But apparently he came in thinking he was going to be the director to this, so I think there was him and Brian Trenchard-Smith did clash because they both
clashed a lot.
And you can kind of tell he's maybe not that happy because he's away from home, he's having to deal with a different crew. I mean, he's got Sammo Hung there who choreographed it, but I think he also did direct some of the action sequences. So it was a very difficult set to be on. But it's just, I mean, this movie has paragliding. I mean, it's got the most amazing song of Starburst. I think it's called Starburst.
Sky High.
Sky High. Yeah, yes. You blew it all to Sky High. I think it's almost as good as friggin' Hard Ticket to Hawaii's.
Yes.
It's really well made. It's really put together. The stunts are incredible. Yeah, you can tell they're kind of almost made up on the spot, which I know a lot of Hong Kong action is, and they obviously brought that to Australia, and of course 1975, Australia did not have any work and safety whatsoever, so it was just all, how did no one die, kind of thing, watching any kind of stunt in Australia during this time period, and it's just one of those sort of magical movies. Yeah, it's kind of well known for a reason, because you do watch it, and you're just like, this is a sequence that has so much paragliding in it, but you love it because of how the music and everything goes together. This is a movie where you think everyone has a wig, but they don't. That is Sammo Hung's hair. That is definitely Hugh Keyes Brian's hair. Like, you just look at that, it's got its own atmosphere. And it's got familiar faces that you know. It's just one of those magic movies that you were just happy to watch, and you're just giggling the whole way through because, George Lazenby has so much personality, and he's such a delightful asshole in this movie. I mean, he's kind of brilliant, and I do love this movie a lot.
I have to agree with both of you. This movie just fucking rocks. I knew I was going to love this movie as soon as, like, I watched it and I was looking on the bus and I was like, is that Sammo Hung? I did not know Sammo Hung was in this movie. This movie has gone up. And then, of course, there's a great fight scene between him and Roger Ward on Uluru, which I did not expect at all. You definitely could not do a scene like that today, but back then, that looks really cool.
Feel, Did anyone else feel pain when you saw, like, the bars and the chain stuck into Uluru? Like, physically, oh, that hurts. Why are you doing that to the – because it's a sacred – Uluru is a sacred – Ezrock is a sacred site. Yeah. You cannot film fight scenes on it anymore. And to see that fight scene, especially Fred Ward beating the shit out of Sammo Hung, is just hilarious to me.
And also, like, how close they are to the edge. I was, like, really, like, freaking out for the both of them, because any one of those two men could have easily have fallen off at some point.
And that was Australian cinema in the 70s.
Exactly. I would say, like, Jimmy Wang Yu. I've seen Jimmy Wang Yu before, because I realized he was the lead in a film I watched a few months ago, The One-Armed Swordsman, and he's fantastic in that movie. His dubbing is definitely not the best in this film, but I think horrendous. That's a physical... Oh, yeah. But as a physical presence, I think he definitely has that, and it makes up for the bad dubbing. But also, like, the supporting cast. Like, I also knew I was going to love this movie because basically, like, Hugh Keyes Byrne plays an agent, but yet he looks like he only just got out of bed after a big night out an hour before.
It's like his character from Stone just suddenly decided to become, like, a cop. Yes. But changed nothing about himself.
And no one believes he's a cop. He constantly has to show his badge to people. Because so even people in Australia are like, going, you're not a cop. Oh, you're a cop.
he's just wonderful in this film.
Oh, he's really amazing.
And Roger Ward's like, the straight man in this film. And he's great too. But what I love so much about this film is when you kind of think about it, this movie's almost nonstop action. Like, there's tons of action throughout all of it. And it's different styles. You get hand-to-hand combat. You get sort of like these big, massive set pieces. And then, of course, like, you get the last half of this film with a car chase scene, which I said to you, Marcy, after this film. Tell me, Marcy, after you watch this scene, that Quentin Tarantino was not inspired by this scene for the end car chase scene in Death Proof.
It's like, the same scene.
Yeah.
It really is.
And we know how much Quentin Tarantino loves Brian Trenchard Smith, so yeah.
Yeah. Also, there's a great fight scene between Jimmy Wang Yu and also, I forgot to mention him in the cast, Grant Page. Extraordinaire. And their fight scene goes on forever. Like, they go through other, like, shops and buildings, and they're smashing into stuff, and it's just such a great fight sequence. And, you know, there's another thing I found interesting about this film is because we talked to how Brian Trenchard Smith and Jimmy Wang Yu did not have the best relationship in this film. This film, and this is a bit of trivia on IMDb, which I found utterly hilarious, is this is the first time ever where two directors actually legit fought on screen, because in the elevator scene where Jimmy Wang Yu is fighting another guy, that other fighter, that's actually Brian Trenchard Smith.
Yeah.
So that's the first time when, because depending on which version you see of this movie, like, Jimmy Wang Yu put a co-director credit on the film.
Yeah.
So it's kind of disputed whether, like, it's all Brian Trenchard Smith or a combination, or maybe Jimmy Wang Yu helped out a little bit but then asked for more credit. So the fact that you got these two guys directing this movie and they're legit fighting on screen, which I thought, and apparently that fight actually legit got Brian Trenchard Smith injured as well.
I mean, you're going up against Jimmy Wang Yu, and if he's not liking you already, he's gonna maybe not hit punch a bit too hard occasionally, because this movie was an Australian Hong Kong co-production. So I think when you've got Jimmy Wang Yu coming in, he's thinking, okay, this is going to be, I'm not sure it was Shaw Brothers who was doing, but it was definitely Hong Kong.
It was Golden Harvest.
Golden Harvest coming in. Yep. I'm also part of Golden Harvest. This is going to be a Golden Harvest movie. And then you're walking in, and of course, Brian Trenchard Smith is not a shrinking violet in any way, shape or form. I mean, this, and so he's like, well, no, this is my movie. So I can kind of see the conflict, but the fact that it sort of brings in that amazing Golden Harvest kind of thing with this kind of exploitation thing, it's kind of the best of both expectations.
Yeah.
And you're getting best of both worlds. And it's just this really fun, dopey, silly movie where a woman comes into contact with Jimmy Wang Yu and they're instantly taking their panties off. It's kind of, and being racist to him at the same time, like, both women are, like, you know, making weird comments to him. I'm like, okay, it's 1965 Australia, fine, whatever. But it's kind of just an amazing miracle of a movie that I love the fact that we get to have this movie around. It's wonderful.
Yeah,
indeed. And
incredible that we got a film this good with all the issues happening. Like, you know, it's two countries that have to work together.
Yeah,
they have sort of this 50-50 approach, but like everything, it really brings in like the spirit of like the Shaw Brothers Golden Harvest type of cinema, but very Aussie as well. And it somehow just works in this very bizarre way. And it's just so fun. But again, like what really got me with this, it was like, why did they get George Lazenby to play Bond when he could have been like a five film Bond villain? Because he's magnetic.
He's too good looking for a Bond movie. They always get to get the weirdos and the not so good looking guys, as in you couldn't be better looking than Bond.
I mean, back then, very handsome man when he was Bond. Like I've actually grown to really like that his Bond film.
Yeah.
It still has issues, but I think he did have something there. But when you see him in this, it's like, holy shit, he had something. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. And George Lazenby, I am 100% convinced, like, the reason why he was cast in the film was because he was James Bond.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a James Bond film. But he is so great as the villain, and he plays it so well. And he does really well in the fight scenes as well. Like, he does a good job with those. And there's a legit scene, again, to show the insanity of this film, is there's a scene where George Lazenby gets burnt.
Yes!
And that... He got burned for real, but that burn goes on for so long, and you can see him, because it's done in slow motion, you can see the horror in his eyes as he's trying to take off that jacket as it's burning.
Yes, because there's a famous story of that Brian Trenchard Smith didn't want to use a stunt double, and like George Lazenby was like, fair enough, saying, no, I am not going to be wearing it. He goes, okay, cool. So Brian Trenchard Smith did the jacket. He put it on fire. He took it off to show how easy it would be. So George is like, fine, I'll set myself on fire. And then when George Lazenby does it, he can't take the jacket off. So that's where you see sort of the horror of him realizing, it's not coming off. And you can kind of see him struggling to get him off. And it's an insane moment because you're like, oh, he's actually on fire. And he did get some burns because of it. And just to show the insanity of Australian cinema in the 70s, it's like, yeah, if we didn't have to use a stunt double, we wouldn't.
Exactly. It was more like, what's a stunt double with a lot of these like action films in the Oz, well, you know, the first 70s 80s ish in exploitation cinema.
I guess if I had to think of like, I guess any negative criticisms I had of this film, I think like the female characters were definitely underdeveloped.
They're piss weak.
They're kind of, in true Bond tradition of that time,
let's be real.
Although I guess the only one who kind of gets out, you know, pretty well is Roz Spears. And I realized, like, watching this film, because I was looking at it, I realized Marcy, she played the awesome sex worker in The Love Epidemic.
Yes, that's right. She was actually really good in that scene.
And, like, she's definitely good here because at least her characters are given a little bit more to do.
Yeah.
And I know she had a bit of a bad experience with Jimmy Wang Yu during the making of this film.
Let's be real.
But I think Rebecca Gilling, who plays Angelica, who's the girl that Jimmy Wang Yu's character, Inspector Leng, is saved by, and then they kind of fall in love, and then like he's like, oh, I'll take you back to Sydney, and then they get caught up in with the bad guys and she gets killed, and for some reason that kind of left a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah, it's very Goldfinger when the women die very early on in that left like, and why?
Yeah, it's like the point of that? Yeah, I mean, you could have easily either not had her die or maybe just have not that character, because, like, you could have taken the character out of the film and it wouldn't affect the story at all. But I just felt like she was just put there just to fall in love.
No, it's purely to give him another sex, somebody can have sex with, because, again, it's that banter, that James Bond thing of he's completely irresistible to women, so when they meet him, they're instantly just taking off their clothes and going, take me now. No, I think Rosalind Spear was really good in it. I think she definitely holds her own, even though I have heard those stories as well. I'm like, Jimmy Yang Liu, why? But it's Yeah, but I think the women are very throwaway. But I think that speaks to the what James Bond was in the 1970s when you don't get those really great, except for maybe Your Majesty's Service, because you have Diana Rigg and she's awesome and knows how to hold her own. You don't get these really strong, amazing Bond female Bond characters until, God, the 2000s? I'm thinking, as much as I love Pierce Brosnan, they're not, I mean, yeah, you've got Famke Janssen, but you don't really get those kind of really great, strong, amazing female characters in Bond. They're kind of things to be used and killed and to have sex with other than having their own thing going on.
Yeah, and it treated that in this film at its most basic core of what they did with Bond. So that's why, that stuff just didn't quite work for me, but the rest of the film,
especially the car chase sequence that just follows it, which goes on for about 15 minutes, and it is glorious.
Phenomenal. Oh,
so great. Truly.
And I was like reading, and Jimmy Wang Yu, because we know he was dubbed over, he was dubbed over by actor Roy Chiao. And for those out there who don't know Roy Chiao is, he would go on to play the minor role of Lao Chen in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Well, there you go.
So I mean, there is so much we could talk about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. because like I said, this movie just fucking rocks. But we still have two more films to discuss, so Marcy, tell us your final thoughts overall on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and how much does this
The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
oh sorry wrong movie The Man from Hong Kong. There's too many movies and TV shows with The Man from in it.
Yes, so. There is a lot.
The Man from Hong Kong, look, it's a very enjoyable film. And yeah, there are obviously some problematic elements. Like we said, there's a bit of racism and the way it treats women. And these are things you expect from older cinema. And, you know, there's no excusing how these things are other than that was the time. That was the norm. We know better now and we can watch this with the context of knowing, you know, I feel like it's not something that it was intentional to be harmful in this case. And I feel like that with a lot of these films. I don't think it's intentional to be harmful. But yeah, like it's such a fun film. The action is phenomenal. George Lazenby just fucking rocks in this film. It's so much fun. I gave it a solid 4 gliding through the cities out of 5.
And what about you, Lindsay?
Same as Marcy said, I adore this movie. But yes, the sexism and the racism feel a little bit more upfront than other movies of this time period that maybe because I do love this movie a lot, I just kind of want it to be better. But even if it does display that very specific Australian way to be racist, as in I'm being your friend but I'm not. But I think just the way this movie is put together, I think the action, I think the non-stop, 4 out of 5 for me as well.
I'm giving this movie 4.5 out of 5 because this movie fucking rocks, as I've been saying. This is the first time saying it so far on the show, but it just is. I just had such a great time watching this film. It is an absolute ball from beginning to end. Like, to me, it's definitely one of the best, you know, action films out there that does a good job at almost replicating the style of a James Bond film. There's a few that I can think of, like the Kingsman films, I think do a good job at replicating that style, but I think at least, you know, that 70s period of James Bond film, this film just did such a good job at capturing that vibe while also bringing that sort of Hong Kong action film flavor to it as well. And the two just mix so well, and it just makes such a fun, awesome little movie. And it's a shame that the movie didn't do as well when it came out. I think it did better outside of Australia than it did here. But this is a film I think is up there. It's probably one of Australia's best action films. It should be talked a lot about more. So, now, moving right along to our next film, because I know we're dying to talk about this one. we're going to be talking about the sex comedy Plug.
It's the zaniest film of the year, Plug. The adventures of a has-been that never was, caught up in the sauciest caper in town. Edward Horatio Plug, super sleuthing in a style of his own. His very own.
alert. A nose for anything.
Puss, kitty, kitty.
Cunning. And above all, persistent. The city's problem is Plug's problem.
You gave me your word as a husband, as an alderman, as a member of the community who cares, that you'd rid the city of those people, those...
Pussycats, dear.
Lord!
Starring Peter Thompson as Plug.
Why me?
Who suffers the inevitable pitfalls.
Private dick.
Undaunted, our hero assumes a variety of disguises. Hot on the tail of Pussycat and Plug are the city's answer to Batman and Robin.
Follow that car!
You?
With Norman Yem as Inspector Closer, a law enforcer in the truest of traditions. Ably backed up by Reg Gorman as Constable Hector. Who has to adjust to any situation.
Goodbye, pussycats.
Meow.
And here she is, the pussycat of pussycats. The sensational, voluptuous, titillating Kelly Kelly. Introducing Cheryl Rixon as Kelly Kelly.
Why do they call you Midnight?
Oh. Sensuous, irresistible. Kelly's assets prove a continuing distraction. And as the plot thickens, our hero shows his true colors.
Pussycats, pussycats, P-U-S-S-Y-C-A-T-S, pussycats.
Vice and virtue combine to bring you an experience you'll never forget. Plug. This film was shot in Skinnerscope and Fleshtone color.
Which was written and directed by Terry Burke, who we previously talked about a couple of episodes back because he wrote and directed the horror film Night of Fear. And this film stars Peter Thompson, Norman Yem, Cheryl Rixon, Reg Gorman, and Joseph First. And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading once again off IMDb, is Plug, a seedy private detective, is hired to watch over a suspected brothel. But with the tenacious inspector closer on his tail, this assignment will prove to be a difficult one. Now, Marcy, I know you have a lot of thoughts on the film Plug.
I have. Look.
Tell us what those thoughts are.
All right, so... On the list of exploitation films that, like, in the order and stuff that we're watching them, this marked the 20th film for the podcast that I'd watched, and it's very easily the worst fucking one. I wasn't really much, you know, I didn't think much of the Naked Bunyip or, Love Epidemic was, you know, so... generally I've given things, you know, a decent rating, because, you know, they've had some merits, even Sidecar Races, which I know we didn't find all that interesting, I still felt there was something there. This, no, absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is shit. This is a shithole of a movie. This is, I don't know what the fuck they were trying to do. Like, you watch Night of Fear, that's 50 minutes of a really solid fucking movie. I'm struggling to believe it's by the same person. Like, what the fuck? Even starring the same person as well. But what the fuck was this? This is them trying to do, like, a sex comedy Pink Panther-type spoof or rip-off or whatever the hell it's meant to be. This was just terrible. Nothing about this film was good. It goes from one thing to the next. There's no real sense of what the storyline is. You don't like anyone. The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting. And there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops. He's wearing a hat. He's making these grunting sounds. And I'm like, did someone see this little sequence and be like, that's fucking creepy. Let's make John Jarrett do that for Mick Taylor.
I would not be surprised at all.
Me neither.
That's why this film gets half a star, because it gets nothing else. Now, it's a half star, and that's me being generous. I barely laughed in this film. It's so stupid. It's so ridiculous. It's not sexy. It's not funny. I kind of laughed at one scene, and then I felt bad about it. There's a scene where you see this lady with a pram, and then suddenly the car smashes into the pram. You realize it's not a real pram. It's a trolley, and there's a bunch of beers in it. They're scattered on the floor. I thought, oh, that's really silly. Ha, ha, ha. Then the woman's crying on the floor going, oh, my God, he's going to kill me. And I'm like, ooh, domestic abuse is not fucking funny. And with alcohol involved, fuck no. What are you doing, movie? I hated this movie. I hated this movie. remember Roger Ebert when he saw North and reviewed it? And he's just like, I hated this movie. I hated this movie. That's me with this. This is my North. This is the film I fucking hate. It was terrible. I'd never want to watch this movie again. I don't want to think about this movie again. But that's all I'm going to say. You don't even have to come back to me for my rating. It's a half a star, and that's being generous. Don't watch this movie. It's crap. If you like this movie, good luck to you. It's shit. That's it.
But,
yes.
But Lindsay, I want to hear your thoughts on Plug.
My first thought, is Plug a movie? I'm not sure.
The question is, it should be more like, is it a movie or something?
Someone brought a camera, but that's maybe, I mean, this feels like people on Antin, I mean, yes, you hear people say, oh, this movie's made with cocaine. This movie feels like it's made with meth.
Yeah.
It's very ugly. It's very confused. I kept forgetting who Plug was, what was going on, why they were after sex workers in a brothel in the first place. It is very disjointed. Everyone is unpleasant. Like, you don't want to look at anyone. Even the the guy trying to order Kelly, I think it's Kelly. She goes, oh, I want her now. It's just this kind of boorish, unpleasant, oh, God, why would anyone want to even be near you kind of thing? Mm. And it's meant to be played for comedy, but it's kind of taking the ugliest elements and going, oh, isn't this funny? And you're like going, no, it's not. It's not. I want to put clothes on all these women to get them away from these men. And I think, yeah, I think there's a sense of trying to kind of I don't know if it's commenting. I think it's kind of the prudish, whatever, I don't even know what they are. The prudish people who are trying to kind of say, yes, we shouldn't have this behavior. And these people who kind of want it, maybe there's a thing there of Australian kind of prudishness, which is definitely a thing. But at the same time, it's an argument for it. It's not like Eskimo Nell, where it's kind of like, yeah, there's a goofy, there's a pretty woman, they're naked, yay, sex, penis jokes. And kind of building something from there. This is just, this is so gross. It feels like you're looking at into a meth addict's teeth and they're all falling down and,
Yeah, this film is like the kind of meth that you don't know where the fuck it's come from, and it's probably really tainted. And when you have it, you're probably going to overdose and be in hospital. That's the
thing. What did you think, B?
Where to start with Plug? There's so much to say about it. I'll just say this. I have to agree with you, Marcy, for this show so far. And I'm surprised it took us about 5 episodes in to find the worst exploitation film that we've done for this podcast so far. It's not to say that every single one of them were winners, but at least even the ones I wasn't hot on at least had some merit in them, like you said. Plug is definitely, it is terrible. There's no doubt about it. I think as a raunchy comedy, it doesn't work. As a satire, it doesn't work. And it's weird that Terry Burke, who did such a good job of Night of Fear and making a film that is a landmark in Australian cinema because it's Australia's first full-fledged horror film, and then he follows up with this? You would think it was made by the same filmmaker because it's so poorly put together. The performances are bad. The humor just does not work at all. And even though it goes for about over 80 minutes, it feels like it goes on for 20 hours.
It really does. And it's got one of the worst egregious, we were talking about sort of racism in A Man from Hong Kong, but it's got the most egregious Middle Eastern stereotype who even says, oh, I'm an Arab, I'm sneaky. And it's like, oh, you not even for 1975, guys, come on. Yeah. It's just, yeah, because I love Night of Fear. Night of Fear is just really solid. this kind of feels like they don't know how to put a movie together. And they literally did not know how to put scenes together or put nowhere to put the camera. It's some really weird shots where you're like, who was shooting this? Were they drunk?
Well, that's the thing, though, because Terry Burke, like, he's kind of done more horror films or thrillers or dramas. So this is his only comedy, and there's probably a good reason why that is.
That's a shit house.
Exactly. And you can definitely tell, even from the beginning as I'm watching this film, it's obvious that he's trying to make a raunchy sex comedy version of The Pink Panther, because there's way too many things in this film.
Yeah, what was that, at the opening? The pink pussy or something?
Yeah, it was like it was like The Pink Panther, but it's a woman it's like a panther with boobs.
Yes.
And it has a little followed by plug, almost done in the style of Inspector Clouseau from the Pink Panther films. But the thing is, what I blew my mind about this animated sequence is that it was directed by Yoram Gross, who's a legendary animation director here in Australia, because he directed Dot and the Kangaroo, all the Dot and the Kangaroo films, Blinky Bill. Like, he is an animation legend here in Australia. And he directed this opening credits. And then, which I think is probably, I would say, one of the very few positive things I can think of this film, but you can definitely tell they're trying way too hard to be a raunchy version of the Pink Panther. Even Norman Yem's character is named Inspector Closer.
Yeah.
And of course, like, Plug and Closer's animosity is kind of like Inspector Clouseau and that other inspector in the Pink Panther film. So that's kind of like the thing there. But Plug as a character is such a gross character, and I think half the time he only just like grunts and stuff like that. It's he's not an interesting protagonist. But I will say this, I'll give Yoram Nam credit, because honestly, I didn't know him, because he played the hermit in Night of Fear, which he was such a gross, disgusting, terrifying character. So seeing him play completely opposite,
but still be gross and disgusting.
Yeah, but it kind of, I had to give him credit, because it's like, oh, this guy actually has a lot of rage. So and to me, he was probably like the best performance in the film, in a quote of bad performances. But yeah, this movie just is, it's pretty bad. I mean, Cheryl Rexit is gorgeous. Don't get me wrong. She's definitely a highlight, but and there's a lot of like nudity throughout, but yeah, it's not enough to say this movie. it's basically being a raunchy comedy for the sake of it, and just not being funny or clever at all.
It's shit. This is the worst film we've seen so far, and it's going to take the shittiest of the shit to knock it off that mantle. I'm just saying that.
And I know that sort of around this period, the orca comedy started to die out around this period. And I'm going to say that Plug was the film that killed
it. It probably did.
It did, yeah. Because I think it just takes all that orca comedy to this kind of place where you're just watching it going, oh, I am not turned on and I'm not laughing. This is just it's not pleasant. I mean, this movie is what I thought that Iskimo Nell was going to be, especially after the first 10 minutes. I was thinking, it's just going to be these kind of awful jokes. But this movie kind of stays in that place where there's Eskimo Joe goes, oh, we'll go somewhere interesting because this is a movie and it needs to progress in some way. Whether this movie is just the same joke over and over again with some going, hitting you over the head going, it's funny, eh? It's funny, eh? No, hit. It's funny. It's like, no, it's not. Please stop. Please. And it does feel like it goes on forever.
Exactly. And it has to say something where a trivia I'm a bit of reading now is that according to the Australian film website, Oz Movies, the Victoria report on Australian box office didn't bother to list this film.
It says everything.
It says everything you need to know on how successful this film was. But now, Marcel, we already know your rating on this film. Lindsay, do you have any final thoughts and rating for Plug?
Plug deserves to be kind of an obscure movie. Like, I love to sort of find obscure movies and go, yes, you should all watch this. And this one, like, nah, it deserves to stay in 1975.
Yeah.
I give it 1 star because people showed up and hopefully got paid. Other than that, it's not a movie that has any real redeeming qualities.
And I apologize that you had to watch this film in order to come on the podcast.
For you guys, I will watch Plug. Not again, though.
Never again.
Just the ones.
if I had to give my final thoughts on this film, yeah, this movie is terrible. Like, there's no beating around the bush. This is a film that, like, I'm a person who believes that films need to be preserved and need to be restored. And in some way, yeah, maybe Plug deserves that too. But maybe it's probably best to, but maybe it's probably best to leave it as a VHS copy rip on YouTube, where it's mostly found these days. Even though it has been released on DVD, but I'm pretty sure it's the same copy that's on YouTube at the moment, which looks like has been the same since the 70s. But it's a terrible film. It doesn't work as a comedy or as a spoof on the Pink Panther. It just doesn't work at all. I mean, I give it credit for Norman Yen's performance and also Cheryl Rixon as Kelly Kelly, because I thought she was absolutely gorgeous. But outside of that, yeah, this movie is definitely a one-star film for sure.
Yeah, it's Plug. That's all you really need.
I mean, even looking at the trivia page for this movie, even the people who put trivia into this movie are trying their best to come up with some kind of interesting trivia for this movie. It's like one that says here, the movie's title refers to the last name of the title character. You don't say.
No shit, Sherlock.
I would like to meet the one person who actually likes this movie just to sort of see why they do, or if, just because I'm curious, because I was repelled. I didn't even click that it was a Pink Panther thing. I was just so repulsed by this movie. I didn't even try and look for what it was actually doing.
But we'll move right along to our fifth and final film for this episode, which, of course, is the Australian comedy documentary Australia After Dark.
We do not often see the dark side of the moon, and we do not often see the dark side of life in the lucky country. This film takes you to see the dark side, the strange and sometimes disturbing trip around darkest Australia. This is Australia After Dark. Journey around this continent, you will see the weird and the beautiful. It won't all be beautiful, and we promise you it won't ever be boring, but it is all true. Sights not captured on film before in Australia. Our cameras will show you the forbidden, the strange fringe dwellers of the night.
Which was directed by John D. Layman, and this is his directorial debut. And we'll be talking about other films of his in the future, because he made other films such as The ABC of Love and Sex, Australia Style, Felicity, Nightmares, and Pacific Banana. So we'll be talking about those films in the future. And this film, it doesn't really have a cast since it's kind of a documentary, but that's debatable. We'll talk about that. The only person I know who's listed here as a cast member is Gina Allen as Underwater Girl. But this film, the plot summary is a 1970s Ozploitation documentary looking at random collection of stories from the dark side of Australian culture. Now, Marcy, this is another documentary on Australia. How does this movie compare to the other ones that we have discussed for this show, like The Love Epidemic and The Naked Bunyip?
The Naked Bunyip, because that's like a really long one. So Like we said, there's some decent elements in there, but I was pretty much like, meh, this is so boring. Look, this one is not that good, but it's sort of weirdly watchable and interesting. And it's weird to say, but I believe, and you could tell from watching it, but it's like they saw like a Mondo film and were like, oh, we need to do that, but for Australia. So it's Australia Does Mondo. And if you don't know what Mondo is, I'd suggest just looking it up. Like Mondo Carne, it's these bizarre sort of documentary, and I put that in inverted commas, sort of looking at these darker elements of society and trying to show shocking things. You know, you look at something like Faces of Death, which goes to the extreme of that. Here it sort of focuses on like the sex element, but not only that, a lot of stuff does feel staged, but apparently, like, yeah, they admit some stuff was staged but based on true stories, but this has no kind of rhyme or reason to it, and it's very hard to keep engaged because one minute they're doing a weird satanic ritual, I don't even know what the fuck it was, then the next minute you got some woman talking about being abducted by aliens, and then you've got a naked lady swimming, and then you're behind the scenes of a porno. I'm like, this is so all over the place, but it's just weirdly fascinating to, like, this is what you think of Australia, quote unquote, after dark. It's very bizarre. And as I'm watching it, like, things just stood out to me. I'm like, look, I'm pretty sure this is a recreation of being on a porno set, but I'm like, I don't know what sort of porno movie this is, because his dick's limp. And he's not going anywhere near inside her, but they're humping. So I don't know what this is. It's very bizarre. It's not that hardcore in a way. There's a lot of scenes that it's just an excuse to show the female body. Like, for, I don't know, 5 minutes or whatever it was, some lady is just rolling around in mud while she's naked and rubbing it all over her tits. And it's like, why? There is no reason. Yeah, it's a very bizarre film, and look, if you want to try and do a Mondo type film, you need more shocking shit, and this just was not, at least. I don't know if a weird satanic sex ritual or whatever the fuck they were doing was meant to be like shocking or something, but I kind of don't believe any of that shit ever really happens. It's so silly. It's an easier watch than Plug.
Oh yeah.
You know, I think it's easier to watch. I guess it doesn't go as long as The Naked Bunyip. It's a bit easier to watch, but you know, something like The Love Epidemic, I actually found a lot more interesting. Even though I know, like, Brian Trenchard Smith says, like, no one should see The Love Epidemic, but the way that film handles things, it's actually very interesting. Not that I want to see, like, VD up close or anything like that. It's just the way it handles themes, and it's very kind of female positive in that film. This is just all over the place, bizarre. It is more kind of like The Naked Bunyip, just not as long, and this one's trying to be a lot more shocking, and it's not. But, yeah, if anything, if it's more watchable than Plug, at least that's something.
What about you, Lindsay? What did you think of Australia After Dark?
I was actually a little surprised by how much I enjoyed it. Not saying I enjoyed it, but I think a little bit more than Marcy, because, yes, I think this is definitely copying Mondo, the Mondo style. I thought that actually all of it was staged. I couldn't think of any scene where this was actually looking at any kind of real life in it, because it was all these, like, it sort of felt like it was being specifically marketed outside Australia to see, oh, look how weird Australia is. Look, they're eating bugs. Look, they're rolling around in paint because that's how Australians do art. And then it had sort of this weird context of, like, this is Australia. It's in support of the Indigenous people and the plight of the abuse that they've suffered. And then it went into this kind of weird, this movie goes into a very specific dedication to Bush, which I kind of had to go, okay, there's only so many ways you're going to be able to shoot this unless you're going to go in between the legs, and you're not going to do that. So it kind of felt half-hearted in a way, but at the same time, it was just, I think just because all the segments were so short and it's not a long movie that it kind of kept my interest, and I was just like going, oh, movie, okay. Yeah, whatever. Okay, that's funny, I guess. And especially just, I watched it straight after Plug, so I think after anything else, it's going to look like a masterpiece. So I think, I think it's an interesting little relic of those kind of documentary styles that they were making in the 70s to try and shock. But I think this feels like it's made for outside of Australia. It doesn't feel like it's made for anyone in Australia at all. But I did find it weirdly engaging in that somewhat weird respect.
I think it's because it goes like from one thing to the other, so you don't have time.
No, you don't. Yeah.
Bored. But yeah, this film has a massive fascination with painting naked bodies and eating food off naked bodies.
Yes.
And that last one, yeah, it was gross.
It's not. I mean, yes, eating honey off a woman, and you're like going, I'm just like thinking, oh God. I mean, every time you do that, you have to change the sheets. I mean, come on, it's just gonna get messy.
You're gonna have ants all over you. This is gross.
indeed. Watching Australia After Dark was an interesting experience because, like, in the first 10 minutes of this film, like, I went through like almost like 20 different stories going through this movie was like. So much happens, and it goes from one thing to the next so quickly. Your mind doesn't have time to process anything that's going on. Like, you get all the scenes, like, you see a scene about, you know, the plight of Indigenous people in Australia, then you get randomly, like,
two fucking minutes, and I'm like, you could have done more with that.
Yeah, then for 2 minutes, it shows, like, you know, women getting painted and stuff like that, and then the next 2 minutes is with the satanic ritual, and then of course you go to a restaurant where they're eating snakes and witchetty grubs. Like, you just, it's like, and this was like almost in the first 10 minutes of this movie, and my mind could not comprehend how fast this film was. And I'm thinking, like, this movie's going to be over before I could even, like, my mind could even get to its level. And but it's interesting. Again, like I've stated before with the other docos that we've talked about, The Love Epidemic and The Naked Bunyip, it's an interest. It definitely does not hold up today as a doco. I mean, obviously, because it came out in 1975, but it's an interesting curiosity piece as well. And what it is interesting as a time capsule, a specific time in Australia. And there's a lot of things, like, again, like those two docos, it's like, there are some things like you find surprisingly progressive for that time. And, you know, people, what we're thinking about now that's going on in our world, they were thinking of as well back in 1975. And of course, you know, there's some backward things as well, but, you know, that's to be expected. But the thing is, though, the film is just so scattershot, and it doesn't take the time to kind of dive deep into these things that, and of course, you know, with some of the scenes being completely staged as well. Like, I know the satanic scene in particular was a staged scene. And I think John D. Lehman actually freely admits that. And just all these other scenes. And the last scene in particular, like with the scene where, like, the couple eating food off each other's bodies, that was not sexy. That was revolting.
Going back to the progressive thing, yes, it does have this kind of weird thing. Like, it does talk about the plight of the Indigenous people of Australia. Like, you know, colonialism came in and all this terrible stuff happened. Because when did they get the vote? Was it 1972 or 1970 or the late 70s?
I know it was the early 70s.
Early 70s. Okay, so that's just happened. And so they kind of start off with this, and then it sort of goes into naked women and people eating bugs. But then it'll have, like, a gay marriage. And but at the same time, I'm watching this thing going, okay, are you being progressive or are you using this as a freak show? Because that's kind of what the movie feels like. It's kind of like you're going into a carnival and you're going, here, looking at all these really weird different things of, like, you know, the two-headed cow or the geek or something like that. And then all of a sudden it's, like, this very progressive thing of showing these two men who are in love, hopefully, because I still think most of it's staged, but oh well. So you're still, in my mind it is. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, so you doing this as a progressive and let's celebrate it, or are you showing this as look how freaky everything
is. Yeah, and it's hard to distinguish. Yeah, it's very hard to kind of work out if that's, you know, which way it's trying to go. But at the same time, I'm like, this country is so backwards. We only just legalized gay marriage like a few years ago. Yes. And this film is saying it was legal. And I'm like, what? And I'm pretty sure like the laws in this country, like, you know, certain things with homosexuality were illegal.
Until yes, they were.
Recently. And I'm like, it's very interesting to see a film from the mid-70s saying this is legal, people do this. And it's like, mate, people still struggle to understand this is a reality now.
Mm.
That we have to have a fucking vote to legalize something that should have been legal all along.
Oh, that's getting messy. That's like, hey, can we just like not do this and say we have to have a referendum so we can just like, oh, we have to think about it like 6 months away. How about you just do it now, because you know that's what most of the country would vote for, and they did. So
exactly.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. Like, you don't know where to put the context. As I said, even at the beginning when they're talking about the Indigenous thing, again, Indigenous people only got the vote in the early 70s to be able to vote, to, you know, actually have power in their hands. And then it goes through, oh, look at them people eating grubs. Okay, let's look at a woman's bush for another 5 minutes. It's kind of hard to know what the context is. And I always got the feeling every single time they would go for something like this, it's like going to a carnival and going to a freak show, which I usually love. But because they had those elements in there, I was like, whoa, hang on a minute. What's going on? How am I meant to actually process this?
Well, I kind of looked this up quickly. September 17th, 1975, South Australia is the first state to decriminalize male homosexuality. So that is when that was decriminalized. And I'm pretty sure something like it was still criminalized in Tasmania until 97.
Oh, 97. Oof.
Yeah. So that's actually quite interesting, and just how this film kind of almost approaches that as like a matter of factly, like, this happens and stuff. But I'm assuming like it's a marriage that wasn't exactly legal. It was more like a commitment to each other. So it's very bizarre, because you can't tell like if it's trying to be that progressive or if it's like, look at the freaks, which they're not, obviously.
No.
This is the stupidest thing to say, but I'm in the context of how the film is saying it, because it's mid-70s Australia, and obviously, you know, as this film was being made, it was still a criminal action, which is ridiculous to think about. But,
indeed. Just to sort of clarify something we were talking about before, when did Australian Indigenous people get the vote? It was actually 1962, not the early 70s. I just looked that up now, so I apologize for getting the dates of that wrong.
And, but yeah, it was 1962. Again, something that's ridiculous. They should have always had that.
Should have had that, but at the same time, this is the Kiwi coming in and thinking there was a, because the referendum was in like 73 or something, but it actually sounds like it was back in the 1970s. Yeah. And the fact, again, we had to have a referendum for that. I think you had ridiculous. A referendum.
This is New Zealand
not knowing Australian history.
I believe we had to, but but it's, I mean, it is an interesting doco. I don't think it's a good doco at all, because like, I think a lot of this, a lot of the stage stuff kind of like was just too silly for me. Like, again, the porno section with the director being completely insane in that scene.
What was up with the sparklers?
I have no idea.
Was he Welsh or German or something? He had a weird accent. I was just like, what are you? Is that put on?
I don't know, but this film was kind of just so weird. And of course, they show a random scene. Of course, like you said before, Marcy, is just a random 2 minute scene of a naked woman just rubbing herself in the mud and stuff like that. And like, what is the point of this?
And the narration is like, oh, is it meant to represent going back into the womb? And I'm like, what is this? Shut up.
I think it's kind of weird. If you look at it, if you look at it as a documentary, it's terrible, because again, people do not just go to a beach naked and start rolling around in mud. That is not how it works. It's never kind of how it kind of worked. There's a lot of things you're like, this is not how it is. But if you kind of look at it as this kind of weird freak show thing, I think it kind of goes, it's whatever it is. Yes, you can sort of say the woman rolling around in the mud is symbolism of her wanting to go back to the womb. and kind of all those kind of weird kind of things. Or how do Australians like to paint? They like to paint on a naked woman, and yeah, look how like good what? It is. Like what? I'm sorry. What's going
and
on now?
Just and lots yeah. and lots of close up shots of bush as well.
Oh my god! I mean, this one scene with the naked beach, and they just like yeah. not even pretend. They kind of pretend, and then it's like, nah, I'm gonna pretend right on there.
and one of the funny bits in this film is like the narrator is like trying to talk about like where the gaze goes, and then he's like, oh, the posterior, and all these words for bum, and then finally I think he says, oh, the bum.
Yeah.
After saying all these things, and I'm like, that was bizarre. And then at the same time, I'm thinking, I hope they got consent to film all these asses.
That was so weird. It's just like a whole sequence of like, some men are leg men, some men like
but
the boobs.
I also,
yeah.
And some men like the bottom. And it's just like, what is happening?
And also, like, the movie, at least that narrator insinuates, like, if men like a woman's bottom, it's sort of, it's means that they might have some hidden homosexuality or something like that. It's just like, where did that come from?
I know. What?
He just ends on that from memory or something. It's just, it doesn't give you a chance to really think about things when they're happening, because as soon as something happens, it's just right on to the next thing, except if it's like the satanic ritual where they're having fake sex or whatever's happening, and you're just like, okay, yeah, whatever. Or it's the porn kind of behind the scenes on a porn set. You're like, okay, you can kind of settle in on those, but most of the time you're just like going from one bizarre thing to the next, and you're just like, okay, what?
What is this?
And there's this, like, also, like, there's a scene in Glue. I think it's a glam performer as well.
Yes.
That whole sequence. That was weird.
I liked that, actually. It's a to a lot of drag performers as well, which is really cool because Sydney, especially Sydney, has such a rich history of drag performers. But again, I'm not entirely sure if that's the, hey, look how cool this is, or hey, look at the freaks, which I'm still not settled on
yeah.
sets. But at the same time, you've got these really kind of glam performers, these drag performers, and they are really cool. And I kind of wish I could stay with them from a lot longer than the movie allows you to. But you're just like, oh, no, on the next thing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think, you know, works with the Naked Bunyip is when you see that kind of side and they're just being very frank with you know, performers and stuff like that, it's a lot more interesting. And this one had a chance to kind of delve into it more, but didn't. It just went to the next thing.
Mm.
Yeah, and I do believe, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there like a quick sequence that involved a transgender exotic dancer?
Yes. I have no idea what was going on. There's a person doing this like striptease burlesque type thing, and then the narrator's going, but is it a man or a woman, and all this stuff, and I'm like,
the whole thing is designed so you look at her bush, which she was shaved in this particular sequence, but that's what it's designed to do. The whole thing was make you look at vagina.
It's like you're waiting, like, okay, so the performer's going to take off the bottoms, and we're going to get like some surprise that's meant to shock or something. But she does. They takes it off, and then it's all, yeah, like you said, it's shaved. I thought maybe something would come out, but then it's just like this glittery star covering the genitals, and I'm like, but what was the point of that?
What is the point of anything in Australia?
It's so bizarre. Yeah.
That is a good question. What was the point of Australia After Dark? What is the point of anything in this movie?
I think I sort of called this in my notes pure exploitation, because there is no point to anything. It's just meant to design to go, look at these weird things. Look at this. Look at this very hairy male ass.
From what I've read about John D. Lehman, from what I understand, he's very much revels in being an exploitation director. So.
Yeah, and this one definitely revels in exploitation because it's not trying to – that's why I can't see this as a documentary, because this is – even though documentaries aren't necessarily there to inform, they're there to show you something specific. This movie is not informing. This movie is not trying to show you another slice of life. It's not showing you a point of view. It is just showing you things that are in a very exploitative lens. And I don't think you can get more exploitation than this movie, and I'm assuming the ABCs of Love and Sex, because that's all he wants to do. And I think there is kind of weird value in that, because you're just looking at these weird things going, ah, weird, ah, hippies, yeah. Cool.
I think this film would have done better if it was just called Mondo Australia, because that's essentially what it is.
Exactly. It is Mondo Australia, and probably should have been called that, but...
Exactly. And, Marcy, this movie is directed by a person, I mean, was executive produced by a person who's been a common recurring name throughout this podcast, Tim Burstall.
Yes.
Who has popped up way too many times on this show.
Yes.
But it's always welcome when he shows up. But, I guess we'll wrap up this talk on Australia After Dark. Marcy, tell us your final thoughts and rating for this film.
It's a very bizarre film. It's strangely watchable in the way that it just goes from one thing to the next and you have no idea what's going on. I gave it the same as The Naked Bunyip, which is 2 satanic weird sex rituals out of 5.
Exactly. And what about you, Lindsay?
This movie is just happy to be exploitative without any meaning behind it. It is just happy to... It really has a dedication to Bush, which I had to give something for it. I'm actually going to give this 3 stars out of 5. I don't think it's particularly good at what it is, but I don't think it's trying to be a documentary at all. I think it's a look at a, hey, look at this, weirdos. Yeah.
I would definitely agree with you, Marcy. This is definitely a 2-star movie, but I don't hate it. That's the thing. I think it is trying to be a mixture of both a doco and a kind of a sort of exploitative shock value of a film. But I don't think it really quite comes together. It's an interesting watch, and it's so scattershot and all over the place that, like, you're never bored at all while watching this film. Although I will never look at food the same way ever again after that sex scene. I pretty much like keep all any like whipped cream, honey, and stuff like that. Just keep it away from me.
Yeah, if you thought the food sex stuff in 9.5 weeks was cringy, this is worse.
Exactly.
Yeah, because there's no lighting in this, so you just kind of. No stylish lighting, I should say. I think everyone feels kind of very what a house would look like kind of thing. And, so when you see that whipped cream and that honey, you're just like, oh, that is gross.
It's so gross.
How sweaty is that person that you're having to lick off right now?
Yeah, I know. that'll be a wrap on this episode of the Ozploid cast. Thank you, Marcy, as always, being a great co-host, as per usual.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Lindsay, for coming on to talk about all these 5 films, and we hope we haven't scarred you for life now.
No, there was only 1 plug, so that was great. No, this was an absolute joy and a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, we're glad you enjoyed being on the show, and you're always welcome to come back anytime to talk about more exploitation films.
Excellent. Yes.
Maybe once we're past the sex comedies and stuff.
Get to the more action, horror and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I think we are almost there, because, like I said, the earliest period of the exploitation movement was, of course, the Orca sex comedies, but we're sort of getting past that now and going into more sort of other genres.
Yeah, it's definitely changing as we're progressing through the 70s.
No, it's been interesting to listen to, because you can hear that kind of progression starting to happen of what's been working, what isn't, all that kind of thing. So it's been great.
Indeed. And Marcy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Yeah, so as per usual, you can check us out at supermarcy.com. We are on all your social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can join the Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/supernetworkgroup. You can find us on the Twitter. I believe it's twitter.com/sm_supernetwork. Yes. Always forget what they are. We are on Instagram, the.super.network. And we are on YouTube. Just look up the Super Network YouTube channel, or look up Super Marcy or Bede. I'm sure you'll find us. There's all sorts of stuff there as well. And we are on TikTok at the Super Network And you can also follow me, if you so desire to, at twitter.com/supermarcy, or you can keep up to date with all my viewings and my lists that I have. I update them when we do podcasts on Letterboxd, and I believe it is super_Marcy. I'm not 100% sure. I believe that's what it is. I don't know how to check these things on, yes, super_Marcy. If you go to my list, I have the list of all the Ozploitation films we're watching as we're watching them with ratings and stuff. So, yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Lindsay, where can people find you on the internet this week?
This week, you can find me on at Reading Geek on Twitter or Reading Geek on Letterboxd, where I usually just have a few ramblings about what I've been watching lately. If you want to follow Schlock and Awe, it is, yeah, Schlock and Awe 1 on Twitter and Instagram. So, yeah, I'm pretty much usually around on those places if you want to find me.
Awesome. And people want to find me personally, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeJamine or my personal writer's page on Facebook at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. And, of course, you can find all my writings over at the Super Network. And also, Marcy, we also should give a little bit of a plug, because at least around the time when this episode drops, because it'll be, since we're a bit late on this episode, we're going to drop it a little bit different. But by the time this episode airs, both mine and yours 31 Days of Horror list should be online.
Yay!
Yes. And hopefully I'll finish it this year, because I did not last year, but I did finish Dunesploitation.
Indeed.
So, yeah, my personal challenge is 31 horror movies I haven't seen before from all over the decades and countries and whatnot, and hopefully do short reviews on all of them. So we'll see if I get there.
Indeed. And I'm doing my usual thing, which is 62, because I'm crazy. Because I always pick like an old and a new film each day. Sometimes there's like you, Lindsay, I do double features, but there's also a sort of a common theme with each film. Yeah. So, but also there's also a bunch of bonus films I've added as well, since I'm also going to watch a lot of the original stuff that's dropping on every streaming service throughout October. So it's going to be a huge list, and you'll have to wait and see what that list is once it's online. Yeah. And yes. That's a wrap on this episode of The King. I almost said The King's Own again. The Ozploit cast. And Marcy's been super. I've been terrible. And Lindsay's just is always making double features nonstop. So we'll see. And we'll be back next month. Yeah. I got to get the list.
So, yes, because I don't remember. I believe next month is In of the Damned.
Yes.
Ooh.
Scobie Malone. Eliza Frazier. Mad Dog Morgan and Phantasm.
Phantasm and Mad Dog Morgan. Yay.
And
Phantasm maybe not, but Mad Dog is interesting.
Exactly. And but for our listeners, we're not talking about the horror film Phantasm. We're talking about the softcore porn comedy Phantasm.
With John Holmes and his big penis.
Exactly. So stay tuned to what how terrified we'll be during that film.
And you can listen to how we will corrupt another guest with a weird sex movie.
Exactly. But so that's a wrap on this episode. We'll be back next month, and stay tuned for that one. See you, everybody. Bye.
Wondering lately, oh baby, tell me where have you been? Now the stage is set, where's my Juliet, baby? Is it maybe my summer night dream? What's my scene? What's my scene? What's my scene? Tell me what's my scene? Thank you.
The Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark, do 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 do. Surfy shark, do 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 do.
And now back to the show.